just start by saying, right, and then you need to turn that off. So can you just, first of all, say your name and your current title?
Yep. So my name is Thomas Kirk, and I am now a research fellow at the University of Nottingham in biomedical engineering, specifically imaging.
Terrific. Thanks very much. So without telling me every minute of your life story, can you just give me the headlines on your career so far, starting really from how you first became interested in, I don't know whether the life sciences or the engineering side of it came first, but in those subjects?
So I was always interested in engineering from a relatively young age, but not interested in the sense that I knew from a long way out, I want to go to university and I want to be an engineer. I know some kids have that quite well-formed life plan. That wasn't the case for me. However, when it came round to applying for university, I was at a very good school where pretty much everyone goes to university. So I was just going with the flow, as it were. But that was the first time where I seriously considered that I could go to Oxford or Cambridge. I had the grades to do that. I applied to Cambridge and didn't get in, actually. I failed that interview. And then I spent a year working as a maths teacher on a Teach First scheme. And then I reapplied for Oxford this time and did much better. And I think the teaching experience I was doing probably helped a lot, because the interviewer at Trinity College, where I applied in Oxford, his wife is a teacher. So we did spend part of the interview talking about the challenges of teaching. And I think that probably helped put me at even. Anyway, Oxford is a special place to do engineering in the UK, like Cambridge, but not many other universities share this property of offering a general engineering course where you specialize as you go on. And initially, biomedical didn't feature on my radar at all. I thought I'd probably end up as a civil engineer. And then after having done 1 year of general engineering at Oxford, realized I absolutely hated civil engineering, hated mechanical engineering. I ended up quite liking electrical, which I never thought would happen. And then there was the influence of one tutor in particular, called Michael Chappell, who I remain working with now at Nottingham. He supervised my PhD, and now I work with him at Nottingham. He is the person that steered me towards biomedical engineering as I went through my degree. So in second year, he started tutoring me for control. And then he supervised me on a small summer project in third year. And then he supervised me for my master's year project in fourth year. And then he invited me to apply for a PhD with him, and so on and so on. And here we are 8 years later, and I'm still working with Michael.
And what was the subject of your PhD?
The subject of my PhD is, so we work in the field of MRI imaging, which is a particular strong point of Oxford, particularly for the brain. And my PhD was working with new types of MRI, in particular one called arterial spin labeling. And it's a very promising modality for investigating the function of the brain and moving towards neurodegenerative disease. And this is because it's measuring entirely different properties of the brain compared to conventional MRI imaging. So the image that you get out of the brain is very different. It tells you very different things compared to a normal MRI.
But it is an image rather than a spectrum looking at.
Yes. It remains an image. Yeah. The challenge is it's very noisy. You get very low quality, very blocky, grainy, noisy images. And therefore, to get around that, you need to use sophisticated mathematics, in particular, a framework called the variational Bayesian framework. And so that was the crux of my PhD, is applying variational Bayes to arterial spin labeling MRI to improve the image quality that you get.
And here's a challenge for your teaching skills. Is it possible to explain variational Bayesian approaches in a way that somebody who doesn't have the maths would understand?
Yeah, it is actually. It's How would you do it? So the crux of variation or Bayes is there are good theoretical reasons why a Bayesian approach is the best strategy to use for this problem at hand. For the problem,
and that's a piece of statistical terminology. Has
exactly.
Yeah.
Bayesian stands in contrast to, I might be jambling my terminology here, but it stands in contrast to likelihood-based approaches. So generally, people will adopt a maximum likelihood approach. A Bayesian approach is similar. There's a subtle difference, but in certain circumstances, a Bayesian approach ends up being the same as a maximum likelihood approach. The difference is that a Bayesian approach allows you to incorporate prior knowledge. So before you've even imaged the patient, there are certain things that we know to be true about what answer will come back. And in particular, our type of MRI measures blood flow in the brain. We measure the rate of delivery of blood to different regions in the brain. And therefore, we know ahead of time that these values will never be negative. And they could be zero, for example. A stroke would be an occlusion, so therefore some regions of the brain will have zero flow, but they will never be negative. And so you have this kind of prior information of what is plausible from physiology. And when you incorporate this prior knowledge into the Bayesian framework, you will end up with answers that are different than you would obtain if you didn't adopt the Bayesian approach, if you used a likelihood-based approach.
But what you're trying to achieve is some level of certainty about what you're looking at on the image.
Mm. Right? Or in fact, actually, qualitatively, you are correct. But one of the really neat things about a Bayesian approach is not only does it give you the estimates of the things you're looking for, it allows you to quantify uncertainty. So in the case of a particularly poor image, you might come back with an answer that says, okay, we believe the blood flow to be this value, but the uncertainty on that is very wide, actually. And that's the maths telling you this wasn't a very good acquisition, whereas in other cases, you'll get a very tight uncertainty. So that's also quite a nice property of it.
So you were working away on this DPhil. You know, very worthwhile, useful thing to be doing. And then at some point, you will have heard that there was something going on in Wuhan. Can you remember, I'm asking everybody this, can you remember when you first heard about the outbreak of COVID in Wuhan? And how long was it before it became apparent to your group that actually this was something that you could jump in and contribute to?
So, yeah, I can remember very well Christmas 2019 reading about it. But even before that, actually, there's something interesting happened that to this day I do not have an explanation for. I was in Shanghai late November 2019.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I flew back with another Oxford PhD, actually. And We flew back to the UK, and I've only ever flown to the Far East, that entire region of the world. I've only ever flown there once, which was this trip. So I don't know if this is normal, but I'm told it's not normal. On the way back home, it was a British Airways flight. At one point, the cabin was sprayed down with a mist, and all of the flight attendants put on respirators and masks. But they didn't give us any notice of what was about to happen. They didn't give us any masks. And then for about 20 seconds, the entire cabin was sprayed down with something. At the time, I assumed it was some sort of infection control, pest control measure. Never has it been explained. I'm led to believe it's not exactly common on flights. I've done a couple of long distance flights from the US and that hasn't happened. And we now know in hindsight that the first confirmed case in Shanghai was a few days after we left Shanghai. Actually, they've managed to date the first COVID case in Shanghai to just afterwards. So for all we know, while we were there, it already started spreading around. So that's curious. And then when it started gathering pace in the UK, we never once did we discuss as a group whether we could contribute. It's not really the way my group operates. We're a computational group. We deal with, you know, quite hardcore imaging. In particular, MRI is not going to be used in a COVID context. It would never be used in an emergency situation. The doctors would always reach for X-ray, CT, things like that, that are much quicker to operate. However, as it was becoming increasingly clear there would be a lockdown, I did email the Jenner Institute, who were working in the floor above me. I was based at the Old Road campus, the IBME. So I emailed the Jenner Institute and said I'd be happy to help out for data analysis, because I presumed at some point they would have reams of data to be crunching through. So they said they would bear the offer in mind, and they added it to a list. I believe they had a list of people who had offered likewise and said, we'll get in touch if we need you, but that never did happen. And then very soon after I made that offer anyway, Oxvent came into my path.
Right, so let's tell that story. So what, clearly after looking at what happened in Italy, there was enormous concern in the UK about hospitals being overwhelmed, shortage of beds, shortage of personnel, and also crucially shortage of ventilators. So how did colleagues of yours come to think that that was an area where they could make a contribution?
Are you on Twitter by any chance?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not. medical Twitter is a very active subset of Twitter. And medical Twitter, I believe, plays an important role in the answer to this question. So the person who really kicked off Oxvent was Robert Starich, who is also a PhD. He's just about finishing his PhD now, actually. And he's also a military medic. Do you know any background about Robert? Or
I did read up a little bit about him as well. Yes.
Yeah, great. So it was him who was looking at the news coming out of Italy. And in particular, he's very active on Twitter, and he's plugged into all the communities of healthcare people on Twitter. And it is my understanding he was the first person to join the dots and think this is going to hit the UK like a train. This is going to be really, really bad. And so he started thinking about emergency ventilation. And then I believe the next person he approached was Andrew Farmery,
who's in anaesthetics.
Yes, correct. And Rob's wife, Anair Starick, she's an anaesthetist who works in intensive care as well. So I believe she might have made the introduction. I'm not sure on that. But either way, Rob has this background in plastics and surgery. Anair, his wife, has the background in intensive care and certainly is more familiar with that part of the medical world. And very soon after Rob started having these ideas, he was put in touch with Andrew Farmery. I believe Andrew Farmery, being the kind of person he is, which is to say, is a wonderful free thinker, actually. He's an excellent person to work with. It's really good fun interacting with him, because he is just a curious, experimental type of person, which is thrilling to be around. So I suspect he was already having many of the same ideas anyway. And then between the pair of them, my understanding is that they quickly built a prototype. They looped in a few other people to this effort. And then the prototype itself was assembled by the engineering workshop at the IBME, in particular the two technicians whose names I'm struggling to remember right now, but I can pull them up later if that would be important.
And what was the I mean, clearly there are designs of ventilator that are out there already. What were the advantages of this of the Oxvent? What became the Oxvent machine? What were the kind of new challenges that it was trying to solve?
Yeah, it's a good question. So cheap and simple above all else is the mantra. I presume that was their guiding principle from the off, cheap and simple. The initial vision was that I wasn't involved in the project at this point, but it would be designed and then the design would be open sourced. And then it could be assembled by anyone around the country who had a sufficiently equipped workshop. And in particular, they were thinking university workshops could probably churn these out, which is why the two technicians at the IBME workshop, who are magicians, they have a long history of creating incredible apparatus, is why they were such a crucial part of this early effort. And so the idea was that using their practical knowledge, they could refine the design and then you'd share it and anyone could start manufacturing from that point. So it was simplicity all the way. Around this time, news must obviously have been spreading internally within Oxford that some people were working on this project. And then the next key person to come on board, in my recollection, is Harrison Steele, he's called. And Harrison is now an associate professor at the Department of Engineering. He was not at the time, I don't believe. He is another one of these people who's a genius. Harrison is probably the most capable individual on the entire project. He really is operating at a level above everyone else. And his expertise is in control and electronics. And he approached Rob and Andrew Farmery and basically said, I will take care of whatever electronics and control is required for this. To which I think their response was along the lines of, that's excellent. We hadn't really thought anything on that topic. So if you're willing to just take care of that, that's great, because that is not something they are familiar with. And then my involvement, at this point, I think I'd been at home for 4 or 5 days, the start of lockdown. And then, my involvement came in because I had previously, Jim, that's his name. I'd previously worked with Jim, the technician at the IBME workshop. I'd done a few projects with him. And I was, once again, I don't know how Rob came to learn this, but basically my name was thrown out as someone who would be a safe pair of hands to liaise with Jim, because like many workshop technicians the world over, there's a certain way of dealing with the people who own a workshop. And in particular, at this point, the project was gaining momentum and lots of people were just agglomerating around the nucleus of the project, but they were all congregating in the workshop. And so there were, a dozen or two dozen people floating around the workshop, getting in the way of the technicians and just generally asking difficult questions and not being, let's say, linearly minded in the way that workshop people like to be very linearly minded. And so my role, Rob approached me to basically say, look, I need to get everyone out of the workshop and I need them to stop asking silly questions to the technicians. And I need someone to be the liaison between the ideas people and the workshop people, someone who can speak the right language to them and just insulate them from all the chaos. And that was my role initially. That's what I was invited in to do.
And you weren't the only graduate student involved in this project.
Oh, no, very much not. Lots of others accumulated. I'm happy to say quite a big chunk of them were Trinity, as it happens. At this point, I am now at Magdalen as a PhD student. I went over to Magdalen College and that's where Rob was. But by sheer coincidence, a lot of the key PhDs happened to be Trinity, including the student Andrew Orr, who was on that news report, which I hope is now in the archives, When Sky News came in to film the prototype operating the ventilator, it was Andrew Orr who was put forward as our representative to demonstrate the prototype working. And he started receiving fan mail, I believe, after that. Various people managed to track him down, and he received quite a lot of emails. So I hope that piece of footage can be located and put in the archives. It's very entertaining.
So how was the prototype being demonstrated? So at this stage, it hadn't actually been used on a patient, presumably.
No, and to my knowledge, I don't think it ever was.
Yeah,
at no stage. The closest it got was either dummy patients. I'm not sure that's the correct term for it. No, at this stage, it was operating on an iron lung, or a rubber lung, rather, which is an ancient piece of apparatus that is covered in rust that I believe dates from the 50s or 60s. You'd have to ask Andrew Farmery. It's my understanding Andrew Farmery has a collection of eclectic equipment and apparatus that should probably have been on the scrap heap a long time ago, but he's
in the museum.
yeah, exactly. That he's somehow saved from the scrap heap. So we were using this. It demonstrates the principles,
which are simply we should I've been kind of making assumptions that people would know what we're talking about, but it delivers oxygen to a patient who's not able to breathe for themselves.
Good point. So a crash course in ventilation. It actually just delivers air. That's the main thing. It is compensating for the patient's inability to breathe in sufficiently under their own power. It is common that you will also enrich it with oxygen. But you probably wouldn't do pure oxygen. That would be a quite severe case if they're on pure oxygen. I think for COVID, most of the time you could, they just needed help breathing with a slightly enriched mix. And there are different modes of ventilation. So the way R1 operated is the most basic. It's called a volume controlled ventilator. So the operator would set a specific volume of air. For an adult, this will be about 400 milliliters. And the ventilator will provide 400 milliliters in one go at a certain frequency. And the patient just has to get with it, really. The patient has to sync themselves up with that rate because the ventilator will do it no matter what. It will deliver that 400 at that frequency. There are more sophisticated modes. So there is a mode that's called pressure controlled, and that's where the ventilator will provide the air at a certain pressure, whereas in volume controlled, the ventilator will basically provide that volume, 400 milliliters, at whatever pressure is necessary to get it in up to a certain point. And the reason why pressure becomes so important is because in acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS, which is the state in which COVID patients end up in when they have difficulty breathing, that was called ARDS, respiratory distress syndrome. I believe there's a stiffening of the respiratory organs. And so to inhale the same volume of air, a much greater force is required from the patient because their membranes and the lungs themselves have become stiffer because of the syndrome. And so that's why the pressures required to achieve the same volume might change during ARDS. And then finally, the most sophisticated forms of ventilation, or I can't entirely remember how they work, to be honest, because it's not at all my background. I suppose the key takeaway here is to note that the ventilator was designed to capture the most basic end of the spectrum of patients that might plausibly be put on it. It was never designed to be a comprehensive ventilator that could handle every situation that was thrown at it. It was designed to be a ventilator that could handle 80% of the bottom 80% of cases, the simple ones, and therefore the top 20% are complex and require very advanced ventilation. You'd be able to put them on the existing high standard ventilators and free up the capacity, basically. So this was, it was a deliberately simple design, and we knew that it would never be able to take care of all situations.
But the idea was that it would be implemented during this pandemic. I mean, there was an urgency about developing it.
Absolutely. So this now leads into phase two of the project, the ventilator challenge. Does that ring any bells?
It's beginning to, but yeah. Talk me through it.
So for posterity, for the future people listening, I will also say at this point that there was a lot of media coverage around the ventilator challenge, and in particular towards the end of it, I believe this would have been April, May, June of 2020, the Financial Times published quite a thorough investigation of behind the scenes in the investigator ventilator challenge. And to my knowledge, that was a very well resourced story, because they were reporting things that A, we knew to be true, but were very much secret. And B, they then reported a whole load of things that we had no idea about ourselves. So for anyone looking in the future to understand the background here, that FT article, I don't know the name of the journalist, unfortunately, but it was very well resourced. So
this was a challenge that was thrown out by the government, was it, to develop?
Yeah, correct. So coming late February, early March, I'm not entirely sure. The state of play was that in Oxford, we had put together a benchtop prototype that was operating. Very basic ventilator, and we were thinking we could, you know, share it around the country and people could crack out a few hundred at a time and it would all be part of this wonderful grassroots effort. And lots of other people had come up with similar ideas. And in particular, after it went on Sky News, other people who'd had similar ideas started sending their ideas to us and saying, oh, maybe you could incorporate this, this, and this, which was very nice, but we ourselves, we didn't really have the capability to do anything with those ideas. We weren't able to start manufacturing in large quantities ourselves. And this is where the ventilator challenge came in. So the government decided to launch this challenge, and they called up all industry and academia to respond to the ventilator challenge. And they set out a specification. It was called the RMVS document, the Rapidly Manufactured Ventilator Specification. And that set out the requirements for a basic ventilator device. It must provide at least this volume, at least this respiratory rate. It must operate for this length of time, et cetera, et cetera. And then teams were call to basically submit their prototype designs that meet that specification. And then there would be a shortlisting stage. And then there was a preparation for manufacture stage where ideas were assigned to other companies who could help accelerate them. And I'm not really sure of all the logistics anymore. And anyway, it doesn't really matter, because the whole thing constantly kept changing in motion anyway, because it was such a stressed, rushed situation. So I believe Oxvent wasn't originally on the shortlist to go through, but then after the Sky News report, I believe we were added to the shortlist at the last minute. At this point, I was still only vaguely involved in the project, so that's why I'm not entirely certain. And then once we were on the shortlist, what then happened is Smith and Nephew, a big medical manufacturing firm in the UK, they had submitted their own idea to the ventilator challenge that was not shortlisted. Can't remember the principles. I think theirs worked on negative pressure, which is logical for Smith and Nephew because their main product, the thing that generates most of their revenue, is it's called negative pressure therapy for wounds. And it's a way of keeping serious wounds clear while they heal, and it dramatically reduces reinfection, etc. So they've already mastered that technology for wound healing. So it's quite logical that they approached ventilation in a similar manner. So Smith and Nephew had put their design forwards. It wasn't shortlisted. And so they were then match made with us by the government, the powers that be. So now the situation was we, Oxford and King's College London, there were at this point a load of anaesthetists and intensive care people had come on board from King's College London. We were matched up with Smith and Nephew to prepare the design for manufacturing. And so around this time, eight of us were, we went, drove up from Oxford to Hull, which is where Smith and Nephew have their main UK manufacturing facility. And yeah, we moved up there to prepare for the next phase of the project. And
at this point, your role was going to change then. At this point, you were no longer simply the gatekeeper of the workshop. You were
So at this point I was Tim Dennison, who was one of the professors at the Oxford end of things, who has a lot of experience in regulatory side of things. He used to work in industry at Medtronic, which is a huge American medical devices firm. He was taking on more of the sort of regulatory strategic direction of the project. And I was never officially assigned a role, but Tim Dennison described me as systems integration lead.
Yes, I saw that. I saw that phrase, and I was going to ask you what it meant.
So systems integration is you know a little bit about everything, and you make sure that it all fuses together. So you know a little bit about the control system, you know a little bit about the manufacturing side of things, you know a little bit about the battery, the power, the sensors, and your responsibility is to make sure everything matches up nicely.
That's a very big responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So I was quite pleased with it because I am a generalist. I think that is what I do best. So I thought it suited me quite well. And though that was the title that someone used to describe what I was doing, it was always very flexible anyway. We didn't really ever have much time to sit down and rigidly define who was doing what. Although, you know, if we were doing things again, that would probably be a good thing to do.
But it was more to do with interpersonal relations management than you weren't actually doing computation. You weren't deploying your skills in maths and computation on this project yourself.
No, a lot of the time there were parts where I did need to do some maths, in particular around calibration. So that would be the most technical contribution I made was around the calibration. But no, for the most part, you're entirely right. It's a team management and common sense role. So in particular, lots of troubleshooting. If a problem arises in a subsystem, we had lots of issues with the electronics, the batteries, the sensors, the things like this. And so an important part of it is, can we redesign around that problem? Can we tweak the design such that that problem goes away? Which more often than not is common sense as opposed to specialist knowledge. So off we went to Hull. At this point, we were given letters by the engineering department, letters that very importantly stated, you know, to whom it may concern, this person is engaged in a mission of national importance. You must let them pass because we didn't know if we'd meet police roadblocks and all of this. We never did once meet a police roadblock. Never once did I have to use my important letter over the whole of COVID, which is a shame. And the other people who came up that of that initial trip to Hull were key people. What was she called? There was our project manager, who I might have to look her name up in a minute, actually. She was very important. She was one of Andrew Farmery's trainee medics, but had previously had a career in the RAF working as an engineer, looking after helicopters, and had made a change, not late in life by any means. She's only 3 or 4 years older than me, I think, but she'd made a change to become a graduate doctor. And so at this stage, she was going through the first years of her medical training, and Andrew Farmery was one of her tutors. And so Chantal Edwards was the name I was looking for. And yeah, she came on as project manager. That was one of the few roles that we did properly define. And that was a role she was magnificent in. She was an excellent, excellent manager. And her RAF experience proved to be very handy, because at two times did we then draw on her RAF contacts in the future. So one of them was to activate this thing called the Civilian Air Corps, which is a network of volunteers who, I presume, live in wait of the day that they will be called up. It's the kind of Thunderbird situation that they've probably been waiting for their whole lives. But COVID was one of those times when you could activate the Civilian Air Corps. And they are volunteers who will undertake missions at times of great need in the national interest. And so one of the times we activated the Civilian Air Corps was to fetch Paul Goulard, who is a professor in engineering at Oxford. And we needed him up in Hull at very, very short notice to trouble fix some software issues we were having. And so I believe from the time that we decided we needed him in Hull to a taxi being sent for him at his house, only an hour elapsed. You know, he got a phone call, pack a bag, a taxi's coming to get you. He's driven to a field somewhere outside Oxford where there's a little propeller plane waiting for him. And then about an hour and a half later, and he's told to pack light as well, because there's not much space in the cabin, and if it's too heavy, the plane won't take off. And then an hour and a half later, he's in Hull, and a volunteer, civilian volunteer, who I've no idea of their name or where they came from, had just flown him up, you know, on his own initiative to Hull and deposited him for us. So that was quite an interesting little vignette. And the other time in which her RAF experience was very handy was obtaining the Queen's helicopter, which I'm not sure if you'd heard of that either. A similar situation. We needed to move some circuit boards that had just been manufactured in Reading by a really fascinating British company. I forget their name at the moment, but quite an innovative, established company who manufacture printed circuit boards, custom interconnects, they're called, I think. And we needed these circuit boards to be with us in Hull as soon as possible, so we could put them in some ventilators that would then be sent out for evaluation testing by the healthcare regulator, the MHRA. Once again, time was of the essence. So through Chantal's RAF contacts, she managed to obtain permission for the Queen's helicopter to do the job. And so it was dispatched off to Reading, picked them up, flew them up to Hull. And we did all down tools at that point, and we all went to the airfield where the helicopter was coming and took some pictures. I think all of the teams, about 50 of us in total, went for that. because that was a partly things were no longer in the super critical stage at that time. So, you know, we just needed to plug the circuit boards in, but a lot of the other work had been done. And partly, I think we all needed the morale boost at that moment in time, because we'd been in the deep dark tunnel for quite a while, which is something that I will now loop back to explain. So, so we arrived in Hull. Initially, the eight of us who'd come up from Oxford, let's call them the, you know, the core eight. We were the boots on the ground, and the brief was, well, I guess the brief was never explained as clearly as it could have been to everyone. My understanding was that the purpose of our going up there was to hand over the project. It was, you guys have, you know, you've done a lovely effort. You've made your prototype design. Thanks very much. We've teamed you up with some professionals now who know what they're doing. So go up there, you know, explain it to them, hand it over, and just let them get on with it. They'll do the rest. I'm not sure what Smith and Nephew were expecting from their side. At any rate, it wasn't quite that. It wasn't quite that neat, clean separation of, this is now your project, I hand it over to you, thanks very much, good luck. It didn't quite work out like that. So the reason why that's important is because we initially went up thinking we'd be there for 2 or 3 days, and so had packed accordingly. I remember I lived quite close to the IBME at the time, so I remember sprinting home and picking up, you know, 2 sets of underwear and a shirt, and that's it, thinking we'd only be there for a few days. Of course, predictably, we ended up staying for 3.5 weeks, during which time I was still on 2 sets of underwear and 2 shirts, and that's it. What happened, the way things did play out, was it was a handover, but it remained a much more collaborative effort. And in particular, the system needed major redesigns in pretty much every respect before it could be manufactured at scale. However, Smith and Nephew on their own would not have been able to achieve those redesigns in a quick enough time frame, let's say. So in particular, the thing that Smith and Nephew excelled at was design for manufacture. So that is, how can we redesign the device such that it becomes extremely easy to manufacture? So one specific example of this was the case of the device, the physical enclosure. They very quickly threw what we'd done out the window, and they went for a single sheet of thin steel that is cut with a laser, and the template is scored into it and cut using a laser, and then it's robotically folded into a box. And so just like that, that single step, you've dramatically simplified the assembly of the whole thing, and it can all be automated. And yes, it's a far superior solution. And so that kind of knowledge was invaluable, and we would never have made those same decisions because we don't manufacture anything. University engineering departments, we sit around having ideas. We don't actually ever have to build anything ourselves, with the exception of Jim in the workshop. So a lot of their design effort went into addressing those kinds of questions. And that's something I was involved in a bit as well. I remember we had quite a fun session in one of their boardrooms, where they had their heads of the manufacturing teams were all there. 4 or 5 people, very senior in manufacturing, were there. And then it was just me and one other from the Oxvent team, and we were basically taking apart the prototype device we had and then reassembling it in different orders. So we kept taking it apart and then trying to assemble it in this order and that order, and time it, how long it took each different route. And that's the kind of basic hands-on work that they do to work out what is the optimal route to assemble it. And the reason that they were putting so much effort into this is because they'd already cleared out one of their warehouses on the site, and they'd started putting together a manufacturing line for it with, I believe there are about 30 or 40 stations on this manufacturing line. They already had a team of volunteers who were going to work the line. And so they were really pouring money and resources into this. In total, they spent in excess of £6 million, I think, on the project. Yeah, and they were really getting ready to manufacture at scale, because that was what we were led to believe was going to happen by the government. But then for the other parts of the other aspects of the project, Oxford, it turns out, needed to remain much more involved. And in particular, the thing that caused by far and away the most headaches was the control software. So there's two types of software on the device. There's a basic interface, which is to say there's a small screen that has buttons on it, and there are menus, and you can scroll through the menus and you can change the settings and you do all of this. And it also measures and reports key metrics about the patient, so their oxygen saturation and things like this. So that's one subset of the system, of the system software. And then the other subset of the system software is the control software. So if the user has requested deliver 400 milliliters at 12 breaths per minute to this patient and do not exceed 25 centimeters of water pressure, what software actually takes responsibility for ensuring that happens? That's the control software. And unfortunately, it turns out that Smith and Nephew, I think this was a learning experience for them that surprised them. Their in-house software team, unfortunately, just did not have the capability to address these problems at speed. And they're particularly important in the context of a medical device because, you know, universities these days, a lot of what we produce is we churn out software. A lot of my degree was churning out software algorithms that are now used in other universities, but they are far from perfect and they have bugs in them. They have bugs that I don't know about. And when a bug arises, someone can email me and, you know, hopefully they bring my attention to it. And then I can fix it. But the bugs are never safety critical because the software I have written is never being used in a life or death situation to make a decision on someone's treatment. The software that goes into a ventilator when someone's in acute respiratory distress is 100% safety critical. And therefore, there are extremely strict rules about how you can write software that goes onto such a device, and how you have to test the software. And they make the process very slow and difficult. It's a laborious process to write software in the correct manner in that kind of application. And so this is where there was a very unfortunate skills gap. One would have assumed that the Smith and Nephew in-house software team had the necessary skills and they'd be able to do that quickly at speed. Unfortunately, Smith and Nephew's in-house software capability was just not very strong at all. Largely, I think, because their existing product lines do not make heavy use of software. It's just not something they've had to do very much previously. We Oxford people, we have a lot of capability in writing software, but we never have to do it in such a constrained, safety critical manner. And so this was by far and away the biggest problem we faced in that second phase of the project when we were preparing to manufacture with Smith & Nephew. We had continual issues with getting the software to work, verifying it was safe, being in regulatory compliance. And that's why we had to fly up Paul Goulart from Oxford at very short notice. He was leading the control side of things. And also special mention should go at this point to Michael Garska, who was another PhD student, he's in Paul's group, or was in Paul's group at the time, also at Trinity. And he was the magician of Git, it's called. Git is a software tool that in this context, it allows people to collaborate. So Git is a mechanism by which you can have 10 people working on different aspects of the same project.
This is the same thing as GitHub. I've heard of GitHub.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it allows, you can have 10 people working on 10 different sections of the same project. And Git is the mechanism that synchronizes it all back together, creates a centralized copy. It's a fabulously powerful tool, but is quite difficult to use, particularly the advanced features. And Michael Garska was a magician at this. He was coordinating everything from his kitchen table. He never did come up to Hull, actually. He was always remote. But I only learned relatively late in the project. He was the guy taking responsibility for that. And in fact, in so doing, he inspired me after this to go out and learn Git properly, because at that point, I'd only ever done it in a very superficial manner. But I now am a bit better at it. But that's purely through having seen firsthand what it's capable of in the hands of someone competent like Michael Garska. So, yeah, I think that that surmises the further development work we had to do in Hull. And then the next phase, also just to say, it was really fun working with the team at Smith & Nephew. They were all volunteers. They didn't have to do it.
Staff members, but volunteers.
Yeah. They were all staff of Smith & Nephew, but all of Smith & Nephew's staff had been sent home at this point, all the non-critical staff. And so this was a group of people that had self-selected, we want to, to keep coming in to work on this. And there were lots of COVID controls on the site, understandably. So in particular, they split up their team into two halves and kept them completely isolated from each other. So there was a design team and a manufacture team. And we only ever met the design team in person. So we could interact physically with the design team, but we never met the manufacture team physically for COVID safety, of course, because we were worried that if COVID spread into their group, then they'd never be able to manufacture. So even though we're all on the same site, we were in buildings next to each other, we had to video conference the whole time to the people next door, which is a real pain when you're trying to, if you're trying to troubleshoot a problem, particularly a problem that has such a physical, tangible form. For example, there's not enough space in the box to put the battery here, and then the circuit board's going to hit it. This kind of really basic issue. It's such a pain to have to be doing that online the whole time. It's just not how people are meant to work.
And where were you living during this period while you were in Hull?
I think it's a Holiday Inn, Travelodge Holiday Inn.
Okay, so a budget hotel.
Yeah, a budget hotel is right next door. We had a fleet of minis, I remember. Mini Oxford gave us a load of minis to run around in, because I didn't have a car. Only a handful of people on the project had a car. So that was nice. Then we brought these minis up from Oxford. We were driving between the hotel and the...
like the Italian job.
Yeah, pretty much. But to be honest, I don't know why we were driving between the hotel and the site, because they're basically next door to each other. It was a 5-minute walk. And then towards the end, I started walking anyway, because I needed time out.
You used the phrase long dark tunnel. I'm just waiting for us to get back to it. You said you're going to expand.
So at this point we're fairly in the tunnel, because it was really punishing up there. The days were really, really long, and we were regularly, we're starting at sort of 7 or 8 in the morning and regularly going past midnight. And then as things reached the crunch time, the thing that I think really ramped up the pressure was when Boris Johnson went into hospital. And he went into Guy's and Thomas's, and he was on the intensive care ward. And it so happened that because we had King's people involved in the project, we had inside knowledge from the ward at Guy's and Thomas's of what his status was. It is my understanding that the news reports at the time, quite understandably, were erring on the more catastrophic side of things compared to what his situation actually was. It is my understanding, based purely off what I heard secondhand from clinicians in the team, that he would probably be okay. Nevertheless, it was at that moment that the magnitude of things really started to sink in, because the isolation was really kicking in at this point. We'd been up there about a week and a half. You're working in a very small team of people. You're not seeing the outside world. Your horizon has shrunk enormously. Also, I happened to be reading a book at the time that is an excellent book, but it was quite bad timing. It's a sci-fi book about the world ending in slow motion. It's called Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson. But I got to the bit where the world starts to end just as COVID was really kicking off. So I remember being in my hotel, reading this book before going to sleep, which probably wasn't helping my spirits enormously. But when Boris Johnson went into hospital, really started to, to sink in, wow, this could be much bigger than we initially thought. Because up to that point, probably naively, given that I was in a slightly privileged position with the information I had access to, but the fundamental message that the government was still putting out was, this will pass. We'll have quite a few difficult weeks. Lots of people will go to hospital, but it will pass. And in a few months' time, we'll be out of this. And there's nothing, nothing catastrophic is going to happen. And it's at that point when the magnitude of things really started landing for me that it could be quite catastrophic. And then the other important effect it had, Boris Johnson going into intensive care, was at this point, the ventilator challenge became complete chaos. Everything just, the wheels came off at a national level. I remember one day we had a call from, I believe it's Lord Agnew, Theo Agnew he was called, who was the person in the Cabinet Office who, along with Michael Gove, was sort of taking responsibility at Cabinet level for the ventilator challenge. And if we were waiting at this point for the go signal, we'd been told the government had placed an order for 6,000 units at minimum. There was an option for 6,000 more, and we'd been told to prepare to manufacture a rate of 5,000 a week, I believe. So, we'd been told we're going to need some upfront, and we're probably going to need you to maintain a high rate of production for a period of time. And so, in response to that, Smith and Nephew, started spending a lot of money. Getting hold of components became a huge challenge, which I'll also come back to in a minute, because this was one of the most chaotic and poorly thought out aspects of the ventilator challenge. It was shockingly coordinated. But when Boris Johnson went into hospital, we got a phone call and we were candidly told off the record, while Boris is in intensive care, no one is going to make any decisions whether you should proceed or not proceed. Decision making stopped. Everything stopped. And it was Michael Gove or Theo Agnew who told us that. And I think at this point, the politics becomes unavoidable. Something that was said about Boris Johnson's cabinet from day one, way before COVID started, but something that was said about his cabinet was his cabinet of lightweights who have been put there because, you know, they're not going to rock the boat. They don't stand up to him. They agree with him. And yeah, we very clearly saw as soon as the man at the top was out of action, everything just ground to a halt. No one was going to make a decision until he was back in action. And that for me, that's when I came to realize there are no adults in the room. That was the main take home of COVID for me, which hit me really hard, actually. But yeah, it was shocking. There's such chaos and there were no adults in the room. You expect when things get really bad, you expect that someone somewhere is going to take the lead and make it okay. So it's a very childlike belief. It's very, you know, innocent belief. And it's these moments like that, you come to realize, no, that is not how the UK operates. I don't know about other countries. Very few countries came through COVID in a good way. But certainly in the UK, there were no adults in the room at this point. It was complete pandemonium. And then because we had been led to believe we needed to manufacture thousands of units, we started going through our supply chain. So this was an exercise in contacting everyone who supplied components for the ventilator and asking them, how many parts have you got available? How quickly can you provide them? And there were a few bottlenecks.
Were they all UK suppliers or were some of them overseas?
Completely global. So in some respects, we were quite innovative and resourceful. So for example, our oxygen sensor that we used in ours was a scuba diving oxygen sensor, and I believe that we were the only people to use a scuba diving oxygen sensor. But that was quite fortuitous for us because I was the one to actually make the call, but I called the supplier up one morning and told them that we'll buy your entire stock, please, and put it on the Smith & Nephew credit card. And that was £500,000 of purchase in one go that I was making on behalf of Smith & Nephew. And that was one of those moments where it's a lot of responsibility that I'd never previously had before. And you come to realize that, you know, Smith & Nephew are really taking a huge amount of trust on this because they're letting 20-year-old PhDs call up and just spend money on their behalf. So that was something where the supply chain was good because no one else was using those devices. And so therefore we had a free run at it. Great. One of the really horrendous bottlenecks was NIST hoses, they're called, NIST. And in any NHS hospital, when you need to access high flow oxygen or pressurized air, there's a plug on the wall and it has a special type of fitting on it, like a garden hose almost. And you can just jam your pipe onto it and it will click. And then you do whatever you needed to do. And that fitting is called a NIST fitting and it's standardized across all hospitals in the UK. I don't know if it's used elsewhere. And so therefore for a ventilator, you need a hose that will plug into the wall and then plug into the device itself. And this is one of the lessons that we've learned globally since COVID is around supply chain concentration and the fact that it turns out in a certain few key areas, the world is hugely dependent on a tiny number of suppliers. In the UK, to my knowledge, there's only one supplier of NIST hoses. And that's probably because day to day, there is a tiny demand for NIST hoses. There's only so many hospitals in the country. They only need so many hoses. Every now and then they probably break and replace them, but that's it. What was not planned for is that one day, something like the Ventilator Challenge would come along and the government would go round to all of British industry and say, you know, what's the maximum number of ventilators you can prepare and start buying the components to do so. And they gave the green light to many teams. And I believe that the total demand for ventilators in the UK was projected at 50 or 60,000. That was the number that was required to get through the first wave, give or take.
And how many are then in normal times in operation in hospitals?
Probably down at 10 or 20,000, yeah. I believe. I'm less certain on that particular figure, given it's not my day-to-day area of expertise. There was this this fateful phone call that happened between all the teams of the Ventilator Challenge with the Cabinet Office. I wasn't on the call, but I'm relaying what I heard about it. And one by one, the person hosting the call for the Cabinet Office went round all the different teams and said, okay, how many ventilators can you produce? And the numbers that were coming back, I mean, for us, I think we answered between 10 and 15,000. We were one of the bigger numbers. But all the big companies that had come on board, companies like Ford, I believe Ford were doing them at Dagenham, Airbus had come on board, Dyson were still claiming that they would be able to manufacture lots. But I'm firmly of the opinion Dyson was only ever a publicity stunt. I do not believe there was ever a serious effort on their part. The problem is that the total number of ventilators that were claimed could be delivered, I believe, came back over 200,000. And so there was now this issue of we've cried wolf, we've got all of industry to put down their tools and focus on this problem all at the same time, with zero coordination between the different groups. We've put all headlong onto this. And now, actually, the number that they've come back with is way over what is required. And yet they still weren't willing to coordinate the supply of resources. And this comes into, this becomes visible. The morning I called the man who manufactures NIST hoses in the UK, of which every single ventilator manufactured by any team would need a NIST hose. That is a part you absolutely cannot design around. And I asked him, how many hoses have you got? How many can you supply? And he just broke down in tears. And he said, you're the fourth call I've had this morning. I've already been asked to provide tens of thousands. I have 1,000 in stock. There are none incoming anytime soon. And you guys keep calling me up and ordering tens of thousands. And then I said, okay, so this is, you know, this is a huge issue. Thank you for telling me. And I tried to find out more about the problem. And what I was planning to do was relay this back to the Cabinet Office, because we'd been given instructions to go out and check your supply chain. And if there are any issues, report them back to the Cabinet Office and we will try and coordinate centrally and try and get involved. And I said this to the guy and I said, I will report this back to the Cabinet Office and hopefully they can tidy it up. And he said, the Cabinet Office have already called me and they just screamed at me and told me to, you know, make it happen, find a way. So there was no, I don't know who placed that call from the Cabinet Office. Maybe it was the Cabinet Office. Maybe it wasn't the Cabinet Office. Maybe it was someone trying to speak, you know, with the authority of the Cabinet Office, because there were dozens of consultants involved in the project at this point, unsurprisingly. Who knows what value they were adding? Certainly the consultant that was added to our project by the Cabinet Office was largely useless. Every morning they would tell us, let me know whatever problems you have and I'll help you fix them. And every time a problem was brought to his attention, he'd say, can't really help you on that one, I'm afraid. So I don't know if this person who'd called up the NIST hose supplier was one of those consultants or not, but at any rate, the guy was pretty much having a breakdown on the phone. And all because basically every team at this point genuinely thought they would be called on to deliver thousands of devices. And so would double and triple booking the same hoses. There was no rationalization, no coordination. And then one of the final resourceful things we did in this phase to get hold of parts was the central component of our ventilator was a rubber balloon, effectively a glorified rubber balloon. And when you squeeze that balloon, that's what pumps air into the patient. And the balloons are manufactured in China. And at this point, pretty much every country in the world had put down an export restriction on any medical product of any nature. And so we had, I think it was 50,000 of these. We'd managed to successfully buy 50,000 of them, and they were in Shanghai in China, but we couldn't get them out of Shanghai because of the export restrictions. And so for a while, lots of creative things were being looked at. Someone, I can't remember who, but someone even had a relationship to Richard Branson. And so at one point we spoke to Richard Branson's PA about, could he send one of his jets over there to pick it up for us? In the end, that didn't come off. The way we got them out, this was Chantal as well. Chantal Edwards was doing a lot of this work. I believe somehow we persuaded someone on the ground in China to label them as footballs. And then Smith and Nephew were able to send one of their planes out to pick them up. We managed to get them out, but it was purely through creative, you know, accounting, let's call it. So these are the kinds of issues that were faced in trying to find enough components to build tens of thousands of devices. But it was complete chaos all over the world, complete chaos.
So, yeah. A very unusual way of spending what should have been the final year of your DPhil. Yeah. So you ended up spending, 3.5 weeks in Hull, and all that happened during that time.
Yeah, it was very...
Ultimately, the 6,000 ordered were never made. Is that correct?
Yeah, so what happened is... our device was sent off for testing in Birmingham, and the first batch of tests came back that the device is, it's fundamentally operable. The device broadly meets what it's required to do, but it's one or two areas require major improvement. And could you also add this thing called respiratory controlled ventilation, which basically... is a slightly different mode of operation where the ventilator will wait for the patient to start breathing in. And once it senses the patient has started breathing in, it will then help them along. So, and all of this came about, well, it struck us as slightly odd. We weren't surprised that one or two areas required improvement. That was entirely predictable. But the fact that the requirements had suddenly increased quite substantially to, we would now like it to be an assisted ventilation where it assists the patient, that was quite a big step up and had not previously been a requirement in the specification. And it all was a little bit sneaky behind the back. And that's the first red flag in hindsight. We then went ballistic for 4 or 5 days trying to implement that change, which happily we could do that entirely in software. It didn't require a physical redesign of the device. it just required reworking the software quite substantially. The problem with that, though, is, as I already mentioned, writing software for a medical device at high speed is extremely complicated, let alone when you have a very, you know, stretched team in place to do it. I never wrote any software for the device. It's not something that's in my skill set. There were only a handful of people that were capable of doing so, and they had already been worked to the bone. You know, at one point I can't remember what Paul Goulart did, but I effectively instructed Paul to leave his computer and go and sleep in the factory because he'd been at his computer for 22 hours or something nonstop and was visibly trembling and he couldn't type anymore. So
I noticed that on your CV, you said that you had the title of Chief Morale Officer.
Yeah.
Was that official or was that just a role you took on?
It was what someone described me as, which I'm very proud of that, actually.
Yes, you should be.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we worked at great speed to do all of that. And this was the point when Tim Denison described it as a death march. It was just a death march.
You felt you knew the project was going nowhere?
Yeah, because we were in limbo. We'd been told you need to be ready for thousands of devices ASAP. And the order never came in. We never got a go order. And for the first part, it was what's happening to Boris Johnson. No one's going to make a decision until he comes out. And then he came out and still no decision was coming. And so we didn't really know what was happening. At this point, I think one or two people had to leave Hull and gone back to Oxford. I just kept breaking down crying at random moments. I started walking in and out of the factory between the hotel just because I needed the time out. But I remember just crying all the time. It was a very intense period. And then we managed to get the device ready to go back for testing a second time in Birmingham. And this time it came back. The test results came back. It met the requirements. It was a sufficient device. I forget the exact terminology that was used on the report, but I have the report myself. We all got a copy of the report, but it meets the requirements. And then we got a letter signed by Michael Gove shortly afterwards saying, you know, thanks so much for all the effort you put into it. But unfortunately, your device is deficient. It just doesn't meet the requirements. And so you can all pack up and go home. And that was that. And what effectively happened, and this is where that big article I mentioned earlier in the FT about the ventilator challenge. What happened is the government got everyone really wound up tight about it. Industry responded in a more forceful way than was anticipated. And to put it bluntly, I think the government didn't want the embarrassment of going round shutting people down. And so they were doing it by the back door, by shifting the goalposts. They kept shifting the goalposts such that they could find an excuse to then say, oh, your device doesn't meet it anymore. And we were naive and stupid, and we didn't read in between the lines that actually it didn't matter whether we kept meeting the new requirements. The government would have just kept doing something to dismiss the whole project. Then there was a brief moment when I think Smith and Nephew were making the case that, look, we've already sunk huge sum of money into this and we've already acquired thousands of parts to build them. Let us build them and send them to India. So then there was this phase of the project of looking for alternative markets. So India was one of them. We looked into Mexico quite a lot. Interestingly, it could have gone to Mexico, but it would have struggled a little bit more because the maximum volume that the ventilator can provide is 600 milliliters. And that
the volume of air you need to provide scales with the body mass of an individual. So you normally do a milliliters per kilogram of body mass figure. Interestingly, in Mexico, they'd have needed a ventilator up to about 800 because average weight is higher in Mexico, basically. You've got heavier people. So it wouldn't have been so well suited, but it could have been perfectly operable for India. And that's where the Oxvent Foundation comes in. It's people, you know, trying to find some use to come out of the device. It could be relevant for a future epidemic. Unfortunately, this is not going to be the last respiratory pandemic the world sees. So it could be useful then. And also the other argument that various people tried to make to the government is you could just spend the money now and buy 10,000 of them and stick them in a warehouse for the next time, because there will be a next time. And to have 10,000 emergency devices would be quite handy. To my knowledge, I believe at the time when the whole ventilator challenge disintegrated, I'm not going to say it was shut down, because it was never shut down properly. It just disintegrated in a completely chaotic, uncontrolled fashion. At that moment in time, I believe Oxvent with Smith and Nephew was the project that had the capacity to manufacture the most ventilators. It was the cheapest. It was about £1,000 per unit, whereas the cost of a typical ICU ventilator device is about £20,000. So it was an incredibly cheap device. Smith and Nephew had managed to get the manufacturing time down to 90 seconds per unit. And it was the only one that could be manufactured at thousands per week. None of the others could do thousands per week. But according to Michael Gove, doesn't meet requirements. It was a deficient device, according to him. Although he doesn't probably know that we have the report from the regulator ourselves anyway, so we know that's complete nonsense. But there you go. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, with hindsight, I think I've heard it said that it actually turned out we didn't need so many ventilators after all, that once they were redistributed from one hospital to another, there were more or less enough to go around. Like the Nightingale, all these Nightingale hospitals that were set up, and in the end, they turned out not to be needed.
Yeah, no, broadly, you are absolutely correct. I think, you know, at moments in time, it would have been useful to have some more ventilators. I'm sure there were moments in time when hospitals were uncomfortably tight on ventilator capacity. But broadly speaking, you are correct. We did not require tens of thousands of devices in the UK, thank God. But that was more luck than anything. Yeah. It just turned out that way. With regards to the Nightingales, an interesting little fact about them is because we designed our device for Nightingales. So during the design process, because we had loads of clinicians on the team, which is a fantastic attribute to have, we were talking to the recently appointed heads of the Nightingales, the people setting them up, and they were telling us what they wanted from our device. So, for example, a standard ICU ventilator comes on a stand. It's got wheels. It is its own thing. Ours is a box that you can put on the floor. You can clip it to a bed. You could clip it to another thing. It's a big steel box so that if you walk into it, it doesn't matter. It is designed to be left lying around in a completely chaotic environment, because that's what the heads of Nightingales, they were calling us up saying, I want this on it, I want that on it. And we were saying, yeah, we can do that. But interestingly, with the Nightingales, it is highly debatable whether if they would have ever been useful, because they would have been staffed by nurses who were already allocated to other hospitals.
Exactly. There just weren't enough people to fill them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in the meantime, you and your colleagues have designed and prototyped and developed the manufacturing process for a device that sounds like a very good device. And does Oxvent still exist as an entity, and what are its plans for the future?
So Oxvent does still exist. It's a social enterprise. I myself, I'm not involved in running Oxvent. I'm not involved in any regard, actually, in Oxvent. It's mainly the professors who are involved in that. I believe they envisage going into other markets where ventilator capacity is more constrained. So broadly speaking, there are many contexts in the developing world where it'd be really handy to have a ventilator. So not just for respiratory disease, but for example, in childbirth, I believe under some circumstances, if there's complication, it can be very advantageous to have a ventilator available. And there's many aspects of the Oxvent that are really nice. You can run it on a compressor, an industrial air compressor, whereas a conventional hospital ventilator requires a medical grade air supply, it's called. To put it simply, if you are in many regions of the world, you're not going to find a medical grade air supply, but a little industrial compressor, no problem at all, you will be able to find that. So that's the vision for it, but I don't know if they've made any great strides in that direction. I believe not at this moment in time.
So for you, all that drama in Hull was over by what, the end of May?
Yeah. And then I came back down to Oxford. My housemates had been having a great time. They'd watched every they'd got baked, pardon the vernacular, and been watching Lord of the Rings back to back. And they'd been having a lovely time because it was really sunny. It was a beautiful spring. And it was a very jarring experience. To this day, I've lived through lockdown subsequently, of course. I have no idea what that first lockdown was like. I hear, so much has been written and said about that lockdown, and people were wondering, oh my God, the world could be different. The world could forever be different. What will it be like when the dust settles? There was a lot of curiosity and hope around that first lockdown. I did not experience any of that because we were in the tunnel. And it took a long time to... I didn't work again until sort of August that year. I mean, I was trying to work, but I wasn't really.
What did you have left to do? Were you just writing up your thesis, or did you still have...
So my final... That was the start of my third year. So I was still about a year to go. I finished in the end. I actually finished entirely on time. It just so happened that when COVID hit, I was ahead of schedule. And then the effects of COVID wiped out that buffer. So in the end, I finished June of 21. And yeah, I was very angry for quite a long time. I still am quite angry at various moments. It comes and goes. I was just really, really angry. And I can't quite put my finger on why, but it's an incredibly demoralizing experience.
Well, you were taken advantage of. I mean, all of you were in a very cynical way, it sounds like to me.
Yeah. We were, we were happy to do so.
And the rest of you, I mean, how did you share your feelings with the other seven people in the group who'd been through all that?
Yeah, I can't speak for everyone, but I know it hit some people incredibly hard. Yeah, it hit some people incredibly hard, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, and then there was COVID project number two.
Yes, which sounds... More fun and with a better outcome and lovely feedback from what I So tell me about that.
Happily, it's a more it's a less roller coaster story. But it's still, it's still unfortunately contains some pretty damning indictments of the system. So that one starts again on Twitter. And it's also Rob Starrock, because he just cannot get enough of Twitter. So it's early 2021, and the vaccination campaign is about to launch. And there were the 9 priority groups that had been identified by the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization. And I believe priority group number 3 or 4 was housebound individuals. And so they would not be able to come to a vaccination centre. The GP or a nurse would need to go to the person's house and vaccinate them on site. And the original target was that those top 4 priority groups, the high vulnerability people, they had to be done within 6 weeks of the vaccination campaign starting. That was the first objective. We need all of them done in 6 weeks. And in order to incentivize GPs, well, I should say also that unlike the majority of the vaccination campaign, where individuals who could do so would go to a central vaccination site, you know, one of the big, massive vaccination centers, and they were organized centrally. And so the NHS is all about layers of responsibility and who's looking after which patient. So for a lot of people, they could go to a central vaccination site, and so the authority lies with some central body within the NHS. Housebound patients were only the responsibility of their local GP. There was no other way that they were going to be vaccinated. It was purely the responsibility of a GP surgery to make sure their housebound patients were taken care of. And that burden falls in extremely asymmetrically. So if you look at the number of patients that are assigned, talking about all patients here, the number of patients assigned to each GP surgery in the country, I believe the figures range from about 1,500 in some regions to over 3,000 in other regions. So the density of patient to GP can vary by 100%. And so you can imagine when it comes to then treating housebound patients, some regions of the country, in particular the Southwest, Devon, Cornwall, the entire Southwest region, will have a much higher density of older patients who are frail and likely to be housebound. And so,
and who probably also live further apart from one another.
Yeah, very rural. Yes. Yeah. So this burden of you need to go and, you know, look after these patients is incredibly asymmetric. And also, astonishingly, no one has any idea how many there are. No one keeps the numbers. I've made 4 freedom of information requests at this point to different authorities within the UK for the total number of housebound patients. The only figure I've been given that has any, let's say, credibility is a lower bound of 250,000. I'm led to believe the number is probably about 500, but no less than 250. But shockingly, no one actually has a number for it. No one's keeping track of that. And we've been told by someone at the Royal College of GPs that this illustrates how the problem even exists in the first place, because no one has responsibility for them in the central NHS. And therefore, why would you count them? They're not my problem. These are patients that consistently fall through the cracks of the system because no one is charged with looking after them from a central point of view. So in order to incentivize GPs to get through vaccinating these people as quick as possible, they started putting incentives down. So there was a £10 uplift, it was called. So for every housebound patient that a GP vaccinated, they would get an extra £10 on top of the existing rate as an incentive for doing so. The missing link was that there was no technology in place to do so. You can throw money at the problem. You can tell people, I'll pay you twice as much money to do it. But unless you really give them the means to do so, that's not actually going to make the problem go away. And this is what Rob became aware of on Twitter. In particular, there was one GP in Wales, outside Merthyr Tydfil, who was tweeting about the challenges he faced, and he'd managed to find a plugin for Google Sheets, whereby if he entered a list of postcodes into Google Sheets, it would automatically locate all of them on a map, on Google Maps, and then he could draw a line between the postcodes and he could make a route. And then he knew, okay, to do these 10 patients, this is the route I'll follow. And he was very pleased with what he'd done. And so he was tweeting about it so that he could share it with other GPs. And it was a very labor-intensive solution, but it was a very crude solution to the problem of how do you efficiently do this. And so Rob brought this to me and said, surely we could automate this, surely we could do better.
It's a traveling salesman problem, isn't it?
It's exactly that. Yeah. And because it's the traveling salesman's problem, solutions for that exist. It's a trivial problem to solve now. There are many solutions out there. And so I got on with that. And 48 hours later, I worked 2 days and two nights. And then we put the beta version online. And off it went. It gained a lot of use very quickly. People started sharing it word of mouth. So on Twitter, there's loads of WhatsApp groups for GPs. So in particular, someone would come across it and then they would put it on a WhatsApp group and they would share it on. We kept the site free to use. So at no point have we charged for it. Partly because we didn't want to, and partly because to set up a whole payments processing system would just be really complicated. It's not the kind of thing you want to do at high speed. I was much more interested in just solving the problem and then getting it out there. But there was, in my rush to do so, there was one thing that would sting us in the tail a little bit further on. So within 2 or 3 weeks, we'd hit 100,000 patients had gone through the site. At one point, about 10,000 patients a day were running through the service.
How do you? Oh, because people would upload their patients to the site, so you could count. So the doctors would upload the patients.
Yeah, the doctors would export an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah,
and then you upload the Excel spreadsheet, and so we can count. And all it was doing, it was an elaborate front end to Google Maps, basically. I would take the patients and the addresses, and I would sort them into smaller groups. So
anonymized, obviously, you didn't have the names.
Yeah. No names. And also postcodes, because postcodes are anonymized. You can't identify an individual from a postcode. It's too broad. But these kinds of data questions just kept rearing their head, unfortunately, not in a constructive way. So say you upload 50 patients, you're not going to go off and vaccinate 50 at once. You'd split them into 5 groups of 10, for example. So that's what the service does. You can choose the group size. It splits them off into these clusters. And then for each cluster, it goes off to Google Maps. It gets Google Maps to do the traveling salesman for you. And then it serves the result back to the user. So it's incredibly simple. And that's how it was able to be built so quickly. Nothing in there is novel or unique. It's just gluing together existing pieces of code that are already out there.
And it's got a name. You should give it its name.
Sorry?
It's got a name.
Oh, VaxiMap. Yeah.
VaxiMap.
My name, actually. I thought of that. I was quite pleased with that one. And then, we hit 100,000 patients really quickly. The problem with this is it was all running on my credit card. So the server costs, you partly you pay to have a server, but that's not actually that expensive. It's about $7 a month. That's fine. The thing that racks up is API costs, they're called. And that's a fee you pay Google for every address that you look up and you route. So you as an individual, when you go on Google Maps, they don't charge you. But if you're starting to do large scale stuff programmatically, they start charging you for that. And I believe I worked out the final figure at some point was about, it was a couple of pennies per patient was the total cost we were paying. But then when you consider that, for some reason that I'm not entirely sure of, there's really interesting usage patterns around it. What people tend to do with VaxiMap is they tend to upload their patients and then they'll generate some routes. They'll look at them, decide whether they like them or not, and then they'll change some settings and then they'll regenerate. So they'll run the same request, we call it. They'll run that 4 or 5 times before they're happy. And then they'll save the final one and use that. But it means that you've paid 4 or 5 times to generate the same routes. And so long story short, very, very quickly, my credit card was £2,000 down in debt. And so the logical thing at this point is you think, well, you'd go to the NHS and say, would you mind awfully just giving us a bit of money to cover this? And they say, absolutely not. They don't want to know. And this just became a Kafka-esque mystery. We were calling around anyone and everyone, trying to persuade them to get involved. So happily, Magdalen College said they would put in at least £1,000. Ideally, could we find someone else as well to match them? We spoke to Oxford University Innovation, the spin-out arm of the uni. They loved it and they were happy to put in, I think, up to 15. But the problem with Oxford funding is it's mainly benefits in kind. So it's money towards lawyers' fees and things like that. They don't really want to just give you a lump sum of cash. And also, the project, you could call it a spin out, but it wasn't really a spin out in any meaningful sense of the word, because we weren't really planning to monetize it in any sense. It's a very time limited problem that, you know, it might be a useful service for a year or two, but then thereafter, it's not, you know, COVID vaccinations are not going to be going on a large scale next year. And so therefore, is there a business case for it? We tried to get the news involved, you know, see if the news would publish some stories about it. But to be honest, they didn't want to take it at all. They didn't care. They didn't even return emails, which I was quite disappointed about. I thought that would have been a really nice, you know, nice little thing. Mm. And then at this point, we had another really interesting idea. This wasn't my idea, actually. Another individual got involved at this point, a mutual friend of both myself and Robert, called Adam Barker, and they had an idea together for a service to reallocate spare vaccine doses at the end of the day. So I don't know if you remember, people were queuing up outside GPs to try and get a spare shot, and this was happening all over the world, this basic principle of, at the end of the day, we just need to get the vaccine in someone, it doesn't matter who. And they quite understandably had the idea, many other people around the world had the same idea, of you could make a system, an online website, where an individual member of the public at the end of the day logs onto the website, puts in their address, and gets told there are 3 spare doses at this GP, or there are 2 over there. As you could do this really short notice allocation for the people who are completely flexible on time, who are happy to just stop work whenever and walk out the door, it would be an ideal system and it would avoid people having to queue for hours. So we actually at this point started building a prototype of that, even though VaxiMap itself was still completely unfunded. We started building a prototype of this other one. And we spent a few days on that. And then when we first brought it to the attention of the NHS, they basically said, no, it would require a level of coordination that is not possible in the NHS at this time is basically the answer that we got. In particular, a company called Accurex were handling all the vaccine booking. They are a private company, and they won the contract to manage the vast majority of vaccine appointment booking. And so I think for our system to have worked, it would have required a deal of integration with Accurex that was just not going to happen, basically. But it's a great shame it didn't happen, because someone in France had the same idea and he built it. And it's called Vite Ma Dose, which means quickly my dose. And he was awarded the Order of Merit for it very soon afterwards. So when I read that in the paper, I was like, oh, damn, that was our idea. We wanted to do that. Yeah, anyway.
You have received some recognition for both your projects. We should say that, because a lot of our conversation so far has been a little on the downbeat side, but there have been awards, have there not?
There was an award for the Oxvent.
Yes.
Yeah. Institute of Engineering and Technology, Global Challenge Grand Innovation Award, I believe it was called, which was a lovely surprise, because I myself did not know we were in the running for that. So that was nice. For VaxiMap, no, not to my knowledge.
I must have been thinking of the Oxford one.
Yeah, not to my knowledge. And so we were having these conversations with different parts of the NHS. This is a important aspect of the way the UK healthcare system is structured. We talk about the NHS, but in reality, there is no NHS. There is no monolithic NHS. What there is a large number of closely related but slightly independent groupings. So you have NHS England, for example. You have NHS Digital. You'd have thought that that was a very obvious place for this VaxiMap project to be parked, NHS Digital. There was NHSX, which is the innovation section of the NHS. And introductions were made for us. Lots and lots of people were, you know, very generously exerting themselves on our part to try and get the powers that be to take notice of this thing. We weren't even trying to sell it to the NHS. We were not trying to sell the whole system to them. We would have happily gifted it to them. We were simply looking for a sum of around £10,000 to just cover the costs. Because I did some calculations and I calculated that £10,000 would more than cover all the costs we could foreseeably hit. And that's not even including any payment for the time that Rob and I put into it. It just covers the actual costs of the running it. And eventually, you know, it went all the way to Patrick Vallance. I have an email from Patrick Vallance on my phone that, you know, got forwarded and forwarded, saying, look, can vaccination not resource this? And he just sent, have forwarded to vaccination leads. Thanks for bringing my attention. And unfortunately, nothing ever came of that. And in essence, the way it went is every single conversation we had with people in the NHS would be along the lines of, this is lovely and we really should resource this, but it's not in my purview to do so. No one was willing to take responsibility. And I think a big part of that is because conventionally primary care is actually one of the bits of the NHS that is more privatized than the rest. GP surgeries are actually independent businesses. So when you have something that is very explicitly geared towards primary care, but has this national level strategic value, no one knows what to make of it. They don't know where to fit it in. And it didn't make sense to go around asking individual GPs to pay for it on an individual basis, because I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to set up shop as an individual calling around making sales and, you know, booking all of it. I've got better things to do. So that's why we just wanted someone in the middle to give us the lump sum of money. And then
then the more we spoke to the NHS, the more they started asking difficult questions around data security and privacy. And from the beginning, I had been very careful around the way I wrote the code. At this point, I'd already had the experience with Oxvent, so I was much more aware of the implications of writing code that is used in a large-scale medical context. So I believe I had made many reasonable attempts to take care of the data privacy and the security aspects of it. And furthermore, there is guidance online from the Information Commissioner's Office that quite clearly states that there are no privacy concerns around what we were doing, because we were just using postcodes, and postcodes are not regarded as identifying information. The problem is, again, dealing with an organization like the NHS, you will get asked this question over and over and over again. And people don't really, they're not willing to take yes for an answer. They'll ask the question because, it is their responsibility to do so, which is understandable. They must always be critical of a new technology that comes in front of them. They must look at it quite carefully. So you can understand that. But none of them are really willing to take yes for an answer, because if you take yes for an answer, you're then implicitly taking responsibility yourself. You are the person who said, okay, I believe this is acceptable. And they don't really want that decision tied to them. So I then spent hours joining phone calls with various information leads across different sections of the NHS, answering the same question again and again and again. But they would never respond to my answers and say, okay, yes, I'm satisfied. They basically just let the conversation die. And that is why at no point did any section of the NHS ever encourage the uptake of VaxiMap. Never did they condone it. Never did they resource it. Never did they recommend it to be used at a primary care level. Instead, we were adopted entirely by a grassroots effort, word of mouth. And in the end, the people who funded it were the UK Army. The Ministry of Defence put the money in because they had seconded, military medics had been seconded to vaccination teams that were roving around the country. That was, it was called Operation Rescript, was the Army's contribution to COVID response. And because all of the military vaccination teams had adopted VaxiMap, they were all using it of their own initiative. Eventually, the person who heads up medical innovation within the Army, it was him who took the initiative, and he who found the money for us, because it was so useful to what the Army were doing.
So if you want a decision taken, go to the Army.
Yeah, they
are in the business of making decisions, aren't they? Yes, indeed.
Yeah. No, he was, who knows, maybe I'll cross paths with him again. But he's one of the few people who's willing to, stick his neck out and make a decision. And it just baffles me that, and by the time the money landed, I think I was close to £3,000 in debt. Me as an individual, unpaid, drawing no salary, not having a job, just having a PhD stipend, and I'm bankrolling part of the UK's vaccination effort. And no one cares. No one wants to listen within the NHS. No one wants to do anything. And the sums of money that are involved are trivial.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. When you hear these stories, well, it must make you absolutely furious when you hear these stories of multi-billion pound contracts handed out to private companies of one kind or another.
So, yeah, we spoke to, there was an individual at the Royal College of GPs, the informatics lead at the Royal College of GPs, and he made some good efforts to help us. And it was very telling at one point. He said, you know what, if you were a consultancy, we'd buy this off you for 5 million. But you're not a consultancy, so we're not going to buy it off you, and nor are we going to deal with you. The NHS just does not have the processes are not in place for engaging like that.
They're very familiar with dealing with consultants. They know how to do that. The commercial department will draw up a contract and legal will swing in, and the process is there, and they do it all day long, and they waste loads of money by doing so. But as soon as there's any kind of grassroots innovation, particularly ironically, given that Rob is a military medic, so Rob is half in the NHS anyway, that kind of process just does not exist. They do not know how to comprehend it and how to engage with it.
So, but now you've moved on to the next stage in your life.
Yes. Yeah.
What are you working on now?
So now I am working with Michael Chappell, my supervisor from Oxford, and we are in the process of spinning out a company, a medical imaging company, mm-hmm. which is related to, well, part of the work I did during my PhD will be in the company, but what I did in my PhD is just the latest in a long line of research efforts that have been made in the group. And it's that long line, that body of historical research that we've done that we're now looking to commercialize. So it is an imaging company, mainly focused on the brain at this moment in time, but maybe we'll be able to spread out in future. And we will be addressing two areas of application. So one of them will be clinical trials. So hopefully we believe that our type of MRI can be very useful in drug discovery. And in fact, the day we are recording this, the 6th of December, 2022, just recently, there's been a lot of discussion around the first Alzheimer's drug.
Yes.
That has significant positive evidence behind it. And this is very interesting because Alzheimer's is one of the holy grails in disease research at the moment. And we hope, and when I say we is the collected community of people around the world who work on ASL, because there are many, many, many of us. We hope that ASL will be extremely useful in the context of Alzheimer's. We hope that it will be very sensitive to the early signs of Alzheimer's. And this is quite interesting in the context of the drug that's just come through, because that drug has been entirely developed around PET imaging. So
positive quantum emission tomography, I guess we should spell it out for.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so it's a nuclear imaging technique. So it involves the use of radioactivity. And the drug that's just been reported on, I think it's called lecanemab. Lecanemab.
Like that, yes.
I'm terrible with drug names. I'm glad I don't actually do.
They're intrinsically myself. Unmemorable, aren't they?
Yeah, and there is a reason for that.
If they end MAB, they're a monoclonal antibody. That's all. And most of the new ones seem to do that.
Right. Well, you have, that's knowledge I did not know. So you already are more qualified in the domain of drug discovery than myself. So the one that's just coming through, it targets the plaques, the amyloid plaque. And this is important because it fits under the amyloid hypothesis, which remains controversial, although now there's some more evidence for it, I guess. But the amyloid hypothesis is one explanation of how Alzheimer's comes about. And therefore, under the amyloid hypothesis, if your drug can remove the amyloid plaques from the brain, that will alleviate the symptoms of the disease. That's the thinking. And the drug does that, and it reduces the amyloids. And I think the figure they reported is about 27% improvement in cognitive function. The reason why this is all interesting in the context of ASL, the MRI we're working with, is the missing link in all of this good news is that for the treatment to be successful, it has to start early. it has to start really quite early. And at the moment, there remains no good systematic way of screening for the early signs of Alzheimer's. The way that they do it at the moment is either doing a CSF sample, which involves taking a small amount of fluid from the body. So that's an invasive procedure. Or they do a PET image, a positron emission tomography. And that also involves injecting the body with a radioactive compound. And so these techniques are, they're well understood, let's say. They're not challenging per se, but they're labor intensive, and you could never run a screening program at national scale on them. It's just too much work. And so this is where the big hope is for MRI, that MRI could hopefully be used to run a screening program to pick up the early signs of Alzheimer's. And then you could put them on a treatment pathway using this new drug. So the fact that we now have a treatment in place, or it looks like we have a first treatment in place for Alzheimer's, it may increase demand for the screening technology to then identify the patients. Because at the moment, one reservation that you hear in the UK, which is quite a cynical, depressing point of view, but is understandable, is there is no point screening for Alzheimer's, because if we find it, we can't do anything.
Yeah.
So why would you bother? But now maybe the calculus has shifted in the other direction. So it's an interesting little project. Company is very small at the moment. It's just me and the supervisor. We're applying for funding early next year. So if we get that, then the company will exist. And I think it will remain, who knows? I mean, maybe it will be very successful and it'll take off very quickly, but I think it will always remain quite a tight-knit company, actually, because
What's the company called?
Quantified Imaging is the name of the company, but we haven't even registered that yet.
All right. Okay.
The company is just a twinkle in our collective eyes at this moment in time. it will be interesting to work in a team again. I do enjoy working in a team. That was definitely the upside of Oxvent, and the upside of having done VaxiMap was that I gained 10 years worth of career experience in 3 months. The level of work that I had to just suddenly jump up to, I personally authored many of the reports that went to the MHRA regulator in the UK. I did a lot of the data analysis. I believe some of that then went to an FDA submission in the US. So yeah, in a very short period of time, I gained 10 years worth of career experience, and I learned a lot about how much I'm worth, actually, as well, in the context of work. Not that I'm a millionaire at this moment in time, definitely not. But
yes, I shouldn't use the word unique, because it's probably not unique, but being able to acquire that level of experience, you already had experience working in an academic context, and then you had to liaise with both clinical researchers and clinical practitioners, and then also with a medical device manufacturing company. So you see something about the commercial world, and then also with government and regulatory bodies. That universe of experience must have been extraordinarily unusual for, as you say, a 20-year-old in the second year of their DPhil.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's not completely unique, but it's almost unique. A few other individuals were in that similar situation. Yeah. There was undoubtedly a silver lining to COVID for me. I didn't get COVID until Christmas of last year, actually. I managed to avoid it for almost 2 years before I finally got COVID.
Yeah, I usually ask everybody how frightened they were of getting it, and the answer tends to scale by age. So obviously people who are older or who have comorbidities are more likely to have been quite frightened about getting it, but and younger people less so. I don't know how you felt.
I think initially I wasn't too frightened at all. That really was the very first period. And then And then, you know, by the time I was doing Oxfam and stuff, I was like, okay, fair enough. It doesn't look as harmless as was initially made out. And then by the time I did get it, I was vaccinated at that point. And I almost certainly had, I believe I was the beta was the wave going through at the time. I was supposed to go to France for Christmas because I am half French, half of my family is in France. And I was supposed to go out there. And then just before going, I finally fell ill with it. And I'm pleased that I didn't get it earlier because it definitely knocked me out for a few days. It's not a pleasant experience. Who knows, maybe on the very first wave, the severity would have been different. But by the time I was vaccinated and I had it, yeah, I really knew I had it.
Yeah.
Not fun.
And did you have experience of friends, colleagues or family members having severe illness with it or being badly affected?
I believe my mum lost her sense of smell for a while. And I only know of one person, let's say an acquaintance, who was at Magdalen College, who died. That was very sad, actually, because he was a person for which he reacted very badly to lockdowns, and became incredibly anxious and didn't handle it well at all. And then he put on a lot of weight. We're talking 30-40% of his body weight he gained in that period of time. And then tragically, it was a week before his first vaccination was due, April 21, or maybe May 21, he caught COVID. And by this point, I think he was so obese, you know, he'd taken on so much weight that he died very soon afterwards. It's the classic case of the comorbidity, COVID and obesity is quite well established, I believe. And I didn't know him as an individual in any meaningful sense. I just knew him as someone around college. But I'm very much of the opinion he's one of those people that lockdown killed inadvertently, which is not, I'm not going to turn that into a broader argument of lockdown was the wrong course of action to take. I genuinely don't know on that question. It's too big of a question for me to pronounce upon. I'm not qualified, but I firmly believe he's one of those inadvertent costs of lockdown. It's very sad. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think we really need to draw two of those. Yeah. It's really interesting. So what, in summary, what would you say are the key lessons that you're going to take forward in how you plan your life and career in future from the time you spent working on these COVID projects?
I think VaxiMap taught me that nothing is ever so simple and so obvious that it hasn't already been tried. Unless Rob had been able to point to people on Twitter saying, I need help for this right now, I would have never even started working on that because I'd have thought, no, it's a solved problem. It's done, not needed. But there you go. Nothing is ever so simple and so obvious that it shouldn't be tried. And from Oxfent. Yeah, from Oxfent, there are no adults in the room. I firmly stand by that conclusion. And in the near future, I believe I want to leave the UK for a period of time and go and live and work abroad and experience something a bit different. I don't think I'm going to find a utopia anywhere. I don't think anywhere is a paragon of being well run. But I think the UK is afflicted by an inability to critically look in upon itself and address the problems that are here. We're very good at deflecting and blaming everything but ourselves, I believe. And in COVID, that really came home to roost.
Great.